But first, we're following breaking news this morning about a mass shooting at a nightclub in Orlando, Florida. This is now being called a domestic terror incident.
He didn't care what he shot, who he shot. It was really heartbreaking.
The FBI telling us today he has been interviewed numerous times for possible connections to terrorism. He used a .223 caliber AR-type rifle and then a 9mm semi-automatic pistol. Those guns he legally purchased just within the past week.
Hello and welcome back to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler and former New York City prosecutor and currently writer on Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, director and co-founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service and author of Policing Domestic Violence.
And Lisa Zambetti, I'm a casting director for Criminal Minds, where I work with Jim Clemente. He writes and I cast for victims, killers, and everything in between.
Great. Well, today we're going to talk about a horrendous event that happened recently, and we really wanted to give people a perspective on a variety of topics that deal with the Orlando shooting. So I just want to start off by saying that those of us at Real Crime Profile want to let everybody know that our hearts go out to the families of the victims of the Orlando shooting. This was a horrific massacre, and it's something that we will never get over as a country, but we should learn from it. And we'd like to talk a little bit about it, about what happened and what might have been done to help prevent that from happening, and certainly what might be done to help it from happening in the future. It's a massacre, and one of the first things I want to say, and I know it's not a popular opinion, is that you can't kill that many people unless you have a weapon of mass destruction. And an AR-15 and any semi-automatic rifle that has a clip with 15, 20, even 30 rounds, maybe more, it's designed to kill the maximum number of people in the minimum amount of time. That is what an assault rifle does. It is a tool. It is a machine. It enables humans to kill more people in a shorter amount of time. Why the average citizen needs this, I don't know. It is not a hunting weapon. It is not a toy. It is not a game. It kills human beings. And the Orlando massacre is a perfect example of that.
I think that's a really good point, Jim. And, you know, this is a weapon that was designed for the military. And I think, you know, certainly when we compare it to the UK, and obviously being from the UK, I'm going to make that comparison. We've had no shootings with an AR-15 because it's just not legal. So, and even when we look at our history, certainly over the last 29 years, we've only ever had 4 mass shootings. So, you know, there is still something here about gun control. Mm. There's definitely something about attitude, and we're going to get into mindset because, of course, a lot of this comes down to the psychology of why does someone do something.
And it's like not this. It's not just gun control. And I know people have said, gun control isn't going to solve this issue. It is one necessary component, though, of the solution. What were you going to say,
Lisa?
Well,
the point is not only did he fire upon unarmed people, victims in the club, he fired upon people who did have guns. The security guards did have guns, and they exchanged fire. So those armed people who were supposed to have guns couldn't stop a weapon like this, obviously.
And the police also had a long, protracted gun battle with him as well. And fortunately, we saw at least one example of where military surplus supplies that went to the police, a Kevlar helmet, saved one of the police officers' lives. But the point is that there is no need for the average citizen to do this, to have a weapon like this. It is, even if it's a Second Amendment right to own weapons, I get that. It is not an unrestricted right. And are people going to take that to the extreme? Are they going to have bazookas and rocket launchers and missile launchers and so forth? I mean, it's just absurd that we've let it go this long. And you would think that people would understand that. Instead, what happened this week?
Well, the sales seem to go up, you know, significantly. I think it was something like 300,000 were sold within one particular store. So I think, you know, some of these kind of cause and consequence things are interesting because obviously people are talking about banning this particular weapon. And, you know, when you look at it, I was just doing a bit of research. This gun's called America's Gun, which I find terrifying in itself. 3.7 million US households have one of these assault rifles. And it was also used in Sandy Hook, in San Bernardino, and also in Orlando. So the last three, you know, high body count. I think Sandy Hook was 27 people were shot dead. Then you've got San Bernardino, 14, and now 50.
Yeah, 50 who were killed. 103 were shot with this weapon. It is simply a matter of math. If you have an assault rifle, you can kill and injure more people faster. If you don't have one, then you can't. The fact is that an assault rifle doesn't protect the average person. You certainly cannot have everybody in a club carrying an assault rifle. So they can't go one-to-one with somebody who walks in with one. And by the way, it's constantly being mentioned that this doesn't happen in states where there's open carry laws. Well, in fact, Orlando is in Florida, which does have an open carry law. So it does not protect citizens. The worst shooting in American history, the worst mass slaying in American history, and it was done in an open carry state, which is supposed to, in inverted commas, protect the public. In fact, it caused the death of 50 people and the injuries, serious injuries, to 53 more.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just for listeners in the UK, because, you know, we don't have all these grades in terms of guns, but certainly looking at Florida, anyone over 18 can buy one of these weapons, and there's no permit needed for pistols or shotguns. It was actually 30,000 of this particular assault rifle were sold this week, which, you know, is just absolutely staggering and frightening in equal measure.
Yeah, well, I think it's probably a response. People thinking, oh, my God, the government's going to try to take it away because of this, so I'm going to get one before they do. And it's that kind of mentality. This entitlement to something that can kill so many is just outrageous in my mind.
Well, it's like having a bomb. I mean, yeah. Basically, it's just as deadly as having a bomb. And you don't have the right to have a bomb.
Correct.
Unless I'm mistaken.
Right. And you know what? You have a right to drive a car, right? But since it is a deadly weapon, cars can kill, there is a licensing procedure. You have to learn certain ways to operate the thing. You have to qualify. You have to repeatedly relicense yourself for your entire life. And if you can't pass the eye exam, if you can't actually drive properly, then you can't have it. And I think at the very least, that should be what is done with assault rifles. There's no reason for everybody to have one. There's no logic in saying that anybody who's 18 has the responsibility to use it properly. But to be able to just walk in at 18 and buy a weapon that can kill, that can shoot and kill 100 plus people in minutes, it's just outrageous in my mind.
It's terrifying. And I must admit, when I went up to the FBI shooting range, I mean, it was an interesting experience when I spent a couple of months at Quantico. And just to see the discipline and rigour that all the agents are tested upon and their accuracy levels and just, you know, the retesting that goes on. Is it every few months, Jim?
I can't remember.
I think it's every few months.
And throughout your entire career.
And if you don't pass, then you can't hold your weapon. And it's,
correct,
you know, firing this weapon from different angles, different positions. And it really is an incredibly rigorous process.
Right. And if they copy that process for everybody who wanted to own one of these things and those people submitted to licensing procedures and also they kept track of their mental health and what they have said or done publicly, I think
and
all
say
that stuff.
Domestic violence, whether it's intelligence or whether convicted, you know,
or
the behavior.
Or if you're on an FBI no-fly list, that might be.
Yeah, but a no-fly list is one thing, but this was an FBI watch list that this shooter was on. And the fact is that he had been questioned a few times based on statements he made. But he had a background investigation by the security company that he worked for. And therefore, he had a right to a firearm. And therefore, basically the FBI, when they interviewed him, didn't find anything out of the ordinary. They weren't able to corroborate any information. And it's basically this. We have freedom of speech here. We also have right to privacy. And many people advocate for the FBI not being involved in everybody's life. The fact is, people are saying Snowden is a great hero because he basically released classified documents about different surveillance techniques and different surveillance operations that are going on around the country and around the world. The fact is, he hurt our surveillance capabilities. People don't want that kind of stuff going on, but then they want to be protected. And you have to draw a line in the sand. Do you want to be protected from people like this, or do you want complete and total privacy? You can't have the government know everything unless they actually are allowed to listen to people who start doing this. And if you're starting to say things like that, the FBI has to stop investigating unless they find probable cause to continue. If they don't find it, if people aren't coming forward, if there isn't actually information. I understand that they use various techniques to try to get more information out of this guy. For example, in certain cases, they introduce people, undercovers, to the situation to find out if this guy is willing to get involved in more serious stuff. It's my understanding that those additional techniques did not bear fruit, and therefore they had to, by law, close that investigation. It's not that they were lazy. It's not that they didn't find any information about this guy, but because it did not meet the threshold, they had to close that investigation. They can't just keep somebody on perpetual watch just because he had used his free speech.
Yeah, well, I think that's always the difficulty in these cases. But one of the things I'd be interested to hear, Jim, from your perspective is, you know, the history of domestic violence on his first wife, which we know the police were called multiple times. You know, in terms of the investigation, she was obviously taken out of the home by her own family because the abuse was...
She was rescued.
She was rescued by them, indeed. And, you know, she believes that she had a lucky escape. And, of course, we've heard that wife number two may have actually been part of this act in the
right.
sense that she was driving him around. She knew that he was buying the ammunition and the holster and that he was allegedly scoping. And I don't know if that's her words, but scoping, you know, particular venues. What's your view on just, you know, the initial investigation and whether should that have played into whether he should have had a firearm, i.e. if it's intelligence and there's not a conviction, does that not have or should that not have a bearing? I mean, for me, I guess what I'm saying is that at what stage would that have a bearing? Would it have to be a conviction? Could it be that there's intelligence and therefore he's not allowed to have a firearm?
Well, I think in this particular case, I think it would be up to the company that he worked for. If they found out that he had allegations of domestic violence, I think they're within their rights to terminate him because of that. However, I don't think that there is any current law that prevents somebody who is accused of domestic violence from getting a firearm. There is no such law in the United States of America. I mean, if he's actually convicted, there are some states that will prevent that from happening, but not all states. I think that opens up a bigger issue, Laura, and I really want to discuss this with you. And because, in my opinion, this case is a hate crime rationalized by religious extremism. In other words, I think it's a convenience that he used religious guidelines, and I'll put that in air quotes or inverted commas, that basically the restrictions against homosexuality in his religion, he's using it in an extreme way to say, I am justified in killing these people because they're homosexuals. The fact is that a lot of information has come out about his own personal behavior since then, that he was on Grindr hooking up with other people for sex, that he had been to this particular gay club a number of times, that he had actually propositioned people or asked other men out, that he may very well have been in a situation where, because of his religious beliefs, be they real or feigned, that there was a internal conflict with him, that he was torn from the inside, whether he was gay or bisexual, we don't know. But the fact is that this led to an intense hatred, a hatred that drove him to act out and kill as many gay people as he possibly could. The fact is that it is not anywhere near the actual teachings of any legitimate religion that you should go out and kill people because they're different from you. And to use that religion as an excuse or a justification to do this is just absolutely absurd. It's criminal. It's horrific.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with anything you've said. And, you know, of course, we've sort of looked at this independently. And, you know, I certainly felt the psychology of this weighs in that this is somebody who's conflicted or who was conflicted. And there was self-loathing within that confliction.
The first thing that came to my mind is that self-hatred.
Yeah, and he's kind of killing himself, you know, over and over in what he sees. That's, and that's the interesting thing, that when you look at what his father said, and I'm always interested just to hear the family, you know, how they react, or maybe it's the things they say or what they don't say. But I think the father came out immediately and said he shouldn't have killed these gay people, as God will punish them, was one of his opening comments. And he said, you know, that his son was enraged by seeing two men kissing recently. And he wasn't motivated by religion, and he didn't know what pushed his son to committing mass murder. So even his father was saying that he wasn't a religious, you know, or sort of using or into sort of extremist ideology. But, and I found all of the what was, sorry, can I just say what's in my mind? Because otherwise I'm going to miss it. And I just found, because it's in response to what you said, that what Obama and the FBI and other people were saying in the immediate aftermath straight away was about him being self-radicalized on the internet. And I'm afraid for me, I still haven't seen any evidence of that. There's no evidence that's saying this is about ideology. The fact he calls up a dispatcher three times when he's committing this crime, this heinous massacre, and he's claiming allegiance to ISIS. I mean, you never normally see someone keep repeatedly calling or using Facebook or using, you know, certain means or mechanisms to keep overstating something. And that's why also I feel this is about somebody who's very conflicted, and it's the self-loathing part that he's acting out here.
All right. Well, there's a few things that you mentioned. One, that his father said God will punish them, at the same time as he's saying this wasn't a religiously motivated action. He doesn't know why his son would commit a mass murder like this. The fact is that's totally internally inconsistent. The father's behavior and the father's judgments were exactly what the son was claiming. So the father's biases and his own prejudices and what he's saying actually reveals the fact that this is totally consistent with what the son actually did. That you said he was killing himself. He was self-loathing and so forth. Well, actually what he did was suicide by cop. But he wanted to do it in a way that made him feel better, feel great, feel part of something bigger. So he made three calls to 911. I mean, what is the point of that? Why in the midst of this would he keep reiterating this? Well, he's overselling. Mm. He's trying to make people believe this is why he did it. It's exactly what we found in the Santa Barbara shooting. Remember the student who was claiming that he was angry at these blonde girls for not paying attention to him, when in fact his actions tended to indicate that what he was more aggrieved at were the guys who would get these girls, the guys who had all these privileges, the guys who he personally stabbed up close and personal, but he shot the women from a distance. It was a very stark contrast between how he dealt with the male victims that he knew that he was ostensibly very jealous of, and the women who he claimed were his real motivation. I think he was trying to present himself as a misogynist, as a masculine guy, when in fact he felt exactly the opposite.
And indeed, he was the opposite. I mean, when we were looking at the video footage of the Santa Barbara shooter, and we make a conscious decision not to mention the shooters' names because we're trying not to give them that platform. But certainly this one had all the most recent in Orlando, for me, had all the similar hallmarks to what happened in Santa Barbara. And when you look at those bits of footage, he was very effeminate. And, you know, the way that he came across. And again, that kind of conflicted nature of repressed homosexual impulses, I think is much more the problem. And certainly when officers went to the Santa Barbara shooter's apartment just before all of this happened, I think it was within days, I think seven of them attended because his counsellor and his mum had called up to say he's having ideation about shooting people, and they were so concerned. And actually that takes a lot for a mum and a counsellor, a psychologist, to do that. So much so that a number of officers go round there. But then when he opens the door, he's so diminutive and just so...
polite and, yeah, and welcoming and calm.
But also just very subservient to their authority. And those things, I think, when he starts to sort of kowtow to their authority, they think, this guy's not a threat. I mean, he's just so meek and mild, and there's no way he could do anything. So they stand down on the risk, and they don't go into the address, which had they have gone into his apartment, they would have found all the weapons.
And they didn't go on social media either.
They didn't check the social media. And as we always say, you know, when you're doing any form of risk assessment now, you have to look at the physical world, but also online to see what's going on. Because he too posted what he was going to do,
right,
as did the Orlando shooter. And I think even putting those messages out there, you know, the fact that he's in the Orlando shooting, he's trying to claim something. I think it's to be part of something higher, but to give honour, as he would see it, to himself and to his family and to his community in some way, or the community that he sees himself attached to. I don't know if he's part of an honour culture, but I would intuit that just from the way that he's behaved and the way that his father spoke, because honour crimes can be committed when somebody is gay, as well as if a female, it can be about gender roles, or a female not playing by the rules and the roles that are bespoke within a... not necessarily even a family, but a community. But it can also happen to gay boys and men if they're not towing the line to the, you know, what's prescribed or what should be expected.
Right. So maybe what happened was he was acting out with other guys, and maybe he was afraid that, or somebody may have found out, or he was afraid that somebody would find out, so he did this extreme thing to counteract what he was actually doing in the real world.
Or is it, can it be like an escalating tension that is just building and building? And is the domestic violence part of that self-loathing? Like, is that kind of what's making him lash out at the women in his life?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that, Lisa, because I've seen quite a number of cases where that is the situation, as in that they are gay, but they're in a marriage, or sometimes have been put in a marriage. You know, it could be arranged or it could be forced, or there may be no honour aspect to it at all, that they've married as sort of a smokescreen. And actually that person then becomes a source of tension because it's not the person that they want to be with. And that's when you can see abuse, sometimes coercive control, but sometimes violence. And I think that kind of explains it. But going back to Jim's point, you know, he certainly was picking up men in clubs, and some of them have been interviewed, and they all knew when this happened. There was a number of them who, as soon as it happened, said, that's got to be him, because he was such an oddball, in inverted commas, that's their word, not mine, that he kind of stood out as being someone conflicted and just, you know, got problems because they don't really know who they are. And he was on, as you said, you know, social media, on apps, but he was certainly, you know, a regular at some of the gay clubs.
Right, and part of that may have been, at least more recently, part of that may have been him scoping out victims and best places to trap people and kill as many as he could. Part of it may have been just him naturally acting on his own sexuality. But I think something you said earlier was very key, and you said the word repressed. The fact is that people who find themselves to have an alternate sexuality than the average or the norm are forced by family, forced by society and community, forced by religion to not live as they are. And because of that, you have a high rate of suicide in some religions, a high rate of acting out badly, self-destructive behavior, and this is the extreme of that. It's not only self-destructive because it's suicide by cop, but it's also destructive because they want to go out in a way where they feel like they're, as you said, maybe bringing honor to their family, or more of a man so that they act in this violent, destructive, horrific way towards other people. It's a shame. It has to stop. We have to wake up. We have to prevent this from happening at its roots. Why can't we just accept people for who they are, stop judging people because they're different, and actually allow people to deal with themselves, their own lives themselves, and let them choose who they are and how they want to express that? That's the only way we can prevent these kinds of incidents from happening. Deal with the root causes. On top of that, don't give them access to weapons of mass destruction, weapons that were made to kill multiple people, weapons that were only intended to be used in the battles in war, period.
I think his first wife actually said some interesting things about him, and just going back to sort of, you know, his conflicted self and some of the things that you've said, Jim, and what you raised, Lisa. I mean, she basically said that he'd express hatred towards everything, you know, in this sense of just being, just having discord with everything because he's not being true to himself. It's not making an excuse for him, but I think when we try and understand the psychology of why someone behaves like this, it has its roots, you know, in childhood. And if he's grown up in a very rigid honour culture, there will be prescribed gender roles, and it will be a very prescriptive thing about what's expected of him. And certainly his father's statement, it just reminded me of the Stanford case, the Stanford rape, when the father came out and said, you know, that he shouldn't be jailed for, you know, 20 minutes of action. You know, people have debated what that word action means, but it tells you about where he's been raised and who he's been raised by. And in an honour culture, I mean, that it's the whole, it's not the sum of the parts, it's the whole that's the greater thing. So actually, he may think he's giving his family back their honour. Maybe his father knew, maybe some of them knew. I would still suspect that even the ex-wife had a sense that maybe all was not necessarily well around his sexual identity. And when you compare her, you know, saying that he didn't have any evidence of extremist views or terrorist links, and that he had a lot of hatred and was violent and abusive, and you think about the wife now, you know, I'm really intrigued by her as to what was going on in their three-year relationship and this three-year-old son that they've got, because it looks like she was actively a part of some of the activities and the behaviours. And, you know, I don't know. I know the Attorney General is looking at whether there are grounds here to charge, and I would suspect that the FBI and everyone is aggressively pursuing that investigation.
Sure. I think that it would be interesting to find out if she was under coercive control.
I was just going to say that. That's what you've taught me. Because at first I was so angry at this woman, and then I thought, well, wait, this is exactly what you say, that she's been brainwashed by him or is under his control to be driving him around and not reporting him.
It could well be. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing that, given his history and that we know that he was abusive, it's not just speculative, it's that we know that that did happen.
But I was,
and she was young, and she's got a 3-year-old son, and we don't know really what was happening in that relationship. I mean, it seems odd that she, you know, if she knew that he intended to actually kill multiple people, for her not to say anything at all. But then when you're in fear for yourself, your life, your child's life, people do very strange things under pressure.
Yeah, and I think that you just hit on the key. If she thought her child's life was in danger, if she reported, then I could see her acting that way. But I also see in situations where people are the victims of domestic violence and coercive control that their self-worth is diminished incredibly. But when they know about somebody else getting hurt, they usually rise to the challenge. They usually do report that. They usually do act on that information because they actually care about other people.
Well, not in the cases I've worked on. You know, when you think about the serial killer Levi Belfield, and there's been many others where actually the women were being coercively controlled and they were so terrified for their own lives. It depends what's at stake. It depends what the odds are. You know, if you're talking about they're protecting their child, right, you know, there's nothing that a parent wouldn't do, as we well know from other cases. So I think we've got to be careful just not to sort of stereotype. And I've tried not to go down that, you know, route intentionally, because you look at the evidence and the facts of what you do know, but you can always get that curveball, that 1% where someone behaves completely differently. And I guess these are all the things, aren't they, that the investigation need to uncover,
right,
as to what the state of that relationship was, what was happening, what she told the police, you know, an FBI on interview. certainly seems like she hasn't really hidden too much. She, by her own admission, said that she drove him around scoping venues. She, by her own admission, said that he was buying ammunition. And
but she may be on a video doing that, so maybe she didn't have a chance to say otherwise. I don't know. Obviously, we need to look at the transcripts of those interviews to know that information. But in the Belfield case, so you were saying the women were afraid for their lives. I get that. But did they have an opportunity to tell that he was going after somebody else?
They did, and there's been a lot of coverage in the media about it, of blaming those women, and we see it in lots of cases. You know,
but
for
in
example,
what circumstances? Like, what were the circumstances that they were saying?
Well, you're going to have to read the book, Jim C., because it's all in there. Comes out next year.
Well, I know. Well, so obviously, I can't have a conversation about it when the book comes out next year. But you could. I mean, you mentioned it, that they had an opportunity. But
they did. I mean, a number of them did call the police at different times. They were terrified, not just for themselves, but for their children. I mean, he had multiple relationships. So he had 13 children with five different women. And some of them feel extreme guilt about knowing certain things that they didn't share with the police because they were so fearful for the consequence and repercussions for them and for their children, because they knew that when he said things, he acted on it. So there has been lots of criticism of them in the media. And in fact, Jo Collins has recently spoken out again, just saying the extreme guilt that she feels. And I think, you know, I've certainly read from other victims. So we had a young girl called Holly Gazzard who was stalked and murdered in her hairdressing salon. And the girlfriend before Holly spoke out about the guilt that she felt, thinking that when he was stalking her and making her life miserable, when she found out he had a new girlfriend, she just felt so relieved that he would now leave her alone, but in the knowledge that she always felt he would go on to kill.
Oh, that's
and so it is heartbreaking, because the guilt that people have to live with, and you know, sometimes I hear victims say, and I had somebody recently say it to me just 2 days ago, you know, things have kind of gone quiet, Laura, and that's a good thing. And I hear he's got a new girlfriend. And, you know, I just hope that he's now going to leave me alone. You know, and I always have two sort of conversations going on. One is that, yes, I want to ensure that we keep you safe. But the second is, well, what about her? And this is why the Register for Serial Domestic Violence Perpetrators and Stalkers is so important.
I agree, totally. And that is a conflict that we always have. And we've always known this as a fact, that when people are obsessively following and stalking and harassing people, many times the only way that's ever going to stop is if they find somebody else. And our laws are not such that we can actually prosecute somebody and stop them from going on to the next person, because we can barely even prove it in this case. So we need to be much more progressive about this and actually understand when somebody has this kind of obsessive behavior and it is dangerous, that we need to be able to stop them and get them locked up and or treated, or it's going to be an ongoing chain over and over and over again.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing is, you can close down someone's behavior. So some of the things that we're calling for in the UK is certainly for a register, for them to be managed under the Violent and Sexual Offenders Register, but also for new orders to be placed on them, i.e. if they start a new relationship, they have to tell the police. If they move to a different area, they have to tell the police. If they change their name by DPOL, they have to tell the police. So they're kind of being proactively managed and tracked and supervised. And I think that's an important part, because it's an order. It's not you go straight to prison. It's that you're being monitored. And it's also in the knowledge that you know that there was a previous victim. And actually, once victims know they're one of a number, then they're much more likely to want to prosecute. And half the time, people don't want to prosecute cases, or they don't want to be part of a prosecution, because it takes so long and they are in fear. Mm-hmm. And while somebody's out on remand or out and about, if they're not in prison, the victim is at risk, and they well know that. So you get a lot of cases where someone's not prosecuted. And I don't know the reasons in this particular case why the first wife, when the police were being called, you know, what happened. But sometimes when we're not seeing prosecutions, it's purely because victims are so terrified. It's not because there isn't evidence. So there's lots of things to consider, but risk and safety of people is absolutely at the centre of that whole discussion. And I'm really, you know, interested to see the developments of what happens with wife number two, to see whether they do arrest her and whether they do charge her. And I think she at the moment, along with the father, is on a no-fly list, on the FBI's no-fly list. But that's as far as they put into the public domain in terms of the next steps.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But I think the important thing that we should end with on this is that this kind of behavior can be avoided if we don't give the people who have these intentions the tools, the means with which they can kill that many people in such a short period of time. It also has to be done with mental health professionals and people actually coming forward and talking about what other people are saying and doing. No law enforcement agency in the world can know everything that's going on. And it has to be a partnership between the community and law enforcement to try to stop these people. But I think one of the most overriding concerns is that we have to stop judging people, whether it's religion, whether it's your culture, whether it's your community, whether it's your family. We have to stop judging people based on sexuality. It is not a legitimate cause to do any harm to any people, anytime.
And the psychology is damaging. But, I mean, just recently somebody did say, it was literally a couple of days ago when I talked about the UK and said that we haven't, you know, we've had 4 cases in the last 29 years, but no cases with this type of weapon. And someone said, well, you have a big problem with knives. And yes, we do have a big problem with knives. But as you and I have discussed before, Jim, you know, with a knife, you don't go in and duel somebody else with a knife. And you certainly can't kill, like you said, you know, 50 people in one situation.
No.
So you just cannot compare two things.
A knife is not a weapon of mass destruction like an assault rifle is. And there have been very notorious cases like the one that happened in China where a guy came in and attacked a school with a knife and he cut a number of children. He even cut off a couple of ears, but not a single person died that day. And that's because he did not have access to a gun.
Well, that's what I always say about the stabbing that I witness. And if that guy had a gun, he would have shot the victim and us
and all the other people
to get rid
around.
Of the witnesses. So, yeah, I want to just tag on to what you said, Jim. I mean, I just, you know, my heart goes out to everybody in Orlando, those families, those victims, and Orlando itself that has had such violence recently. I mean, this is one in a string of horrible incidents of violence there. And, you know, my heart goes out to everyone there. And,
And also to Christina Grimmie's family.
Exactly.
And, you know, that happened in Orlando. Mm-hmm. I think that was it on the same day?
It was just a day before.
The day before, she was
not long before.
Singing in a gig, and her, what was called in the papers, her obsessive and infatuated fan, you know, traveled to Orlando and managed to get into this gig. And then as she's signing autographs at the end, she opens her arms to hug him and to sort of sign, and he shot her dead. And, you know, just an absolutely horrific situation. And I think, you know, even when the media describe it and they don't use the word stalking, people don't understand really what's gone on. And his co-workers were talking about him obsessing about her and saying that he was going to marry her, and he had hair transplants and all sorts of things done because in his mind they were going to be together forever. And, you know, her family, her career was really just taking off, and she seemed like a beautiful person.
So you have mental health issue, stalking, and gun. You put those three together, it's always going to be the perfect storm. It is something we need to intervene on. And one of the things that we can absolutely control, that's within our control, is the gun. We can't always know what's going on in somebody's mind. We can't always know and prevent somebody from being a stalker, but we can actually control who gets a gun.
And understand the risk markers. And of course, in the UK, I mean, last week was just such a terrible, terrible week. It was harrowing, I think, you know, just the news. But in the UK, we had something very rare happen too, in that one of our MPs, Joe Cox,
Member of Parliament,
lost her life. Well, I should say was murdered in cold blood, was shot dead while she was in her constituency. And, you know, I just want to say, you know, that our thoughts are with her family, because, you know, she was one of the leading lights campaigning and doing incredible work of, you know, on violence against women and girls. And She was a mum. She had two children. And, you know, I just watched as events unfolded and I felt incredibly sad, you know, across last week. So I just want to say that our thoughts, certainly from Real Crime Profile, are with all the families of Definitely. All the cases we ever speak about, but in particular last week.
Yeah. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And we just wanted to do this podcast because, obviously, these events of last week or so really affected us all. And again, our hearts go out to the victims and their families. And we hope that with this kind of insight, maybe we can move forward in preventing this from happening again. So on behalf of Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, and myself, this is Jim Clementi signing off for Real Crime Profile. So if you're a fan of the show and you want to help us out, there's a few things you can do. First, subscribe to the show on iTunes, talk to your friends about us, and share the links. And it'd also be great if you could take a survey from our new network, Wondery, at wondery.com/survey.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214-946-4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800-799-7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.